Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back at the ITP and see so many old friends. What I'm going to talk about today is been retired for a while from teaching, actually 23 years. And I had a hobby which I engaged in. When you teach, you don't have much time for it, but it's always curious about how our great discovery or great physicists discover things. You know what, some of them had divine revelation or apples falling on their head or what have you. And in the books, the textbook where we teach, they give you little stories about how certain discoveries were made. Well, I've had now some chance to examine these stories and go into archives and so on, and almost everything you learn from our physics textbooks is bunk. Nothing to do with what really happens. It's always much more complicated. And I've been particularly interested in the beginning of our physics, which is actually due to Isaac Newton. I mean, how did he make all these beautiful discoveries that you know, angular momentum conservation, energy conservation, F equal ma, which he never wrote down. But how did he do it? And I've been pursuing this on and off, and only in the last few months, I think I put it together, and I call this atelier, not a workshop, because I believe that what Newton was doing secretly under the table was graphics, you know, with pencil and ruler, rather than calculus, which he himself said he thought was not as elegant as geometry. Well, let me start perhaps, and by the way, I apologize for sitting down for two reasons. One is I'm very shaky on my head, and the other is I have to push the button here because my setup doesn't work, so I think it's better to be close to the computer. Now let me start with some comments that were made by Chandrasekhar, who was one of our greatest astrophysicists. And he, like all of us retired people, only really started looking into the Principia in his old age. And he was stunned, as you can see, by what he found. I mean, so many beautiful things, blah, blah, blah. And he actually rated Newton over Einstein in terms of brilliancy. So he wrote, in fact, an entire book to explain it all. But in my view, it isn't really very much more readable. It's supposed to be for the common reader. A common reader who doesn't know a lot of geometry and calculus wouldn't follow his book either. So he really didn't advance very much. Now, this is a book that I found written in 1898 by Ruthin Braumann, and it really summarizes the essence of what's in the Principia in a very beautiful way. And the book is turns everything into our modern calculus, those things. So if you really want to see a good textbook on the Principia, I recommend this book, which has been is now on sale in Amazon. Some years ago, when I got interested in Newton, I found that Richard Dalitz, many of you know Dalitz. Dalitz got an interest in this subject because he was a good friend of Chandrasekhar. He organized Chandrasekhar's lectures before he published the book. He organized Chandrasekhar's lecture in Oxford. And so when I met with, and I knew, had many interactions with Dick, and so I said to him, well, you know, maybe we should have a little meeting with all the great men. And you see a photo here that has basically all the scholars, or Newtonian scholars, that we got together and we had them give lectures of, I want to just point. There's Dalitz, okay? And this fellow here is Ivy Cohen, who many of you may have read some of his books. He spent his entire life, you know, on Newton. And the other fellow who worked very much is Rupert Hall, who contributed early on. And, you know, many of these people here. And then, of course, this is the granddaddy, Whiteside, as a young man. See, the Royal Society took their best people and said, well, you know, here are here Newton's manuscript now. Let's make them public. Well, you know, they never got around doing anything. And this guy, Whiteside, was a young man who knew Latin and self-trained in mathematics, and he produced 8 volumes, which I think you have in, maybe you don't have them in your library, but there are 8 volumes in which all the theorems and the Principia are discussed with copious footnotes. But again, you know, Whiteside was a self-trained mathematician, and when I looked at some of his footnotes, turned out to there were lots of errors, but he didn't advance the subject. In particular, he accused of Newton not understanding things. I mean, it's very common for historians. Could I see a show of hands? Is anybody here in history or science? So I can speak freely. Well, historians are extremely valuable because they go to the archives and then they tell you what's in the archives and so on. But my contact with all of the fellows that are here is that the mathematics was really not up to Newton. And so they either relied on what Whiteside had to say, and when Whiteside made mistakes, they repeated Whiteside mistakes. And anyway, to make a story short, unfortunately now, most of the grand old men are not with us anymore. Here is a very, you know, the kind of question that I want to talk about today. We know that neither the Principia nor Optics sprang like Minerva from the head of Jove. I mean, there must be some antecedent, something that motivates all of these things. But all the papers, you know, all the documents on how he did it have disappeared. Nothing was published. Nothing was published. Newton's, for 5 years, the reason I took this segment from 1679 to 1684, the 5 years where, in spite of the numerous publications of papers of Newton that have survived, there are nearly 1,600 papers are online. Not a single one gives you a hint of how he did it. And of course, historians would very much like to know, because it's an interesting question, how he got started. And like many great physicists, you know, they start scratching, you know, things and ideas, and they start working things out. But they like to present at the end the results in a beautiful, self-contained manner. And Newton particularly presented his things in a way that, I don't know if I have a... You know, there's one guy who has been maligned in the literature, and he's actually not a physicist or a mathematician, he was an economist. And he was right when he said, certainly there can be no doubt that the peculiar geometrical form in which the position of the Principia is dressed up bears no resemblance at all to the mental process by which Newton actually arrived at his calculations. Now, when I first saw that statement, I said, oh, well, the economists don't know what they're talking about. He was absolutely right. There's no resemblance between the published book, the beautiful final form in which he published it, and the way that I now want to try to convince you, which is the likely way that he actually... you remember that statue is in the cover of Chandrasekhar's book, right? But do you notice something peculiar? Here in the statue, he's looking that away. In the book, he took the mirror image so that Newton seems to be looking at Chandrasekhar's book. I just find that amusing because I didn't realize it. But this is the statue. It's a famous statue that is in the Royal Society. And this is a picture I took of it. Now, I gave a lecture on some of this stuff many years ago. And I gave actually a lecture to students at a school in Westminster Abbey. You know, there's a school there where all the great people in England, you know, studied when they were in high school. And at the end of it, they gave me an honorarium, £1. And as you can see, this honorarium, let me see. Very interesting, because there is Newton there with the Principia in his hands, his famous telescope, you know, and here is the banknote. And as you notice, the banknote has the elliptical motion with the sun at the center. Do I hear any remarks? The sun at the center of the ellipse? I mean, this note was in for a couple of years before somebody pointed out that the sun should be at the focus, not at the center. This is not the right proposition. They copied the wrong proposition. But you know, it's a very valuable pound now because they have to discontinue it. They also produced a stamp. And what's interesting about this stamp, incidentally, is that it also has a diagram. But this diagram is correct. And it's the diagram of proposition 71, where the hang-up Newton had, you know, with the apple and the moon, is that he had to extrapolate gravitational force to the surface of the Earth. But to treat the surface of the Earth as if it was a point gravitational, Newton was too smart to buy into that. But he finally actually produced a proof that if you have a sphere but as long as it's radially symmetric, the force at the surface is the same as if all the mass was concentrated in the center. And he didn't prove that until he was already on his way. So it was a very important thing. Newton was incredibly, he kept at it until he had it right. And this was an important point. Now, there's a portrait of Isaac Newton in the National Gallery in London I once visited many years ago. It's one of my favorite portraits. I mean, once he was famous, you know, there were dozens of portraits. Some of them are hanging in the Royal Society. This one is hanging in the... But I noticed something curious when I was there. I looked at the caption, you know, Photograph caption, and it basically said that Newton had made his discovery because of divine revelation. So when I left the gallery, you know, I saw a little note that you could make comments, and I decided to scribble a comment that Newton wasn't a priest or a divine. No, it wasn't divine revelation. It was scientific. And my wife was furious that I was wasting my time. But later I got a nice letter from the curator saying that, you know, this was not done by the present curator, but the old one. But she agreed with me that was a bad caption and decided that she would change it. And I don't know what the caption reads now, but she hoped that I would agree with the new caption. I've forgotten. I've lost it. But it was not divine revelation, okay? I mean, scientists... Nice thing about physics is, it may be divine revelation. Some of you may get it, but I think that wasn't the way he did it. Now, why is the Newton so? Why is the book so obscure? When the book appeared, Historians tell us that only a handful, maybe five or six, of the best mathematicians in Europe could figure out what it was all about. The book was literally incomprehensible, and many people think it's still unreadable up to the present time. And Newton once wrote, he said, he didn't want little smatterers in mathematics to bother him. He had very thin skin. He didn't want to have to explain it to the hoi polloi, right? And so he made this obscure on purpose. He did not want to clarify what the heck it was all about. And if you try to follow the details of his proofs, they are geometrically, but they use a lot of very sophisticated geometry of Apollonius, theorems that Feynman told us once he didn't understand. Feynman claims he didn't understand the proofs because he didn't know what the theorems is. Chandrasekhar fakes it. He says a well-known proof, blah, blah, blah. Well, the well-known proof, nobody knows how to prove it. It's a proof in geometry about properties of an ellipse, and they're very essential proofs if you want to follow it. So if you can't do, and then could I show your hands how many people have glimpsed at the Principia here? Well, that's pretty good. How many people have followed the proofs? Or you follow the proofs? Let's talk later, yeah? You're probably a mathematician, right? Or at least you love mathematics. I mean, the proofs are really, really hard. I mean, there is a new edition by Bernard Cohen, which I highly recommend, called A Guide to the Newton's Principia. And he devotes, I mean, I don't know, 6 or 7 pages to one proof. Another proof takes 12 pages to elucidate. And again, there are theorems that are mentioned that are not shown how they are proved. So it's complicated. So it isn't accidental that the book is unreadable to only the most tenacious colleagues. And I will say I'm among the people who, when I first tried to read it, I did what Chandrasekhar read. I mean, you know, I read the theorem, and then I went, you know, and did a little calculation using calculus. So I could see the proof on calculus. But what was fantastic is that Newton's proofs, you may take 3 or 4 pages of calculus calculations, but the geometrical proof, it can be done in one page. So it's a very powerful tool, and Newton kept saying, you know, geometry is better than all this analytic stuff. The other thing is geometrically, you sometimes see what's going on, and if you write down F equal MA in differential form, until you actually calculate something, you don't know what's going to come out. And in some cases, you know, there's no analytic solution, so you actually have to go through analytic processes. Yeah, this is just what I said, okay? Now, why is the year 1679, 5 years before the publication, important? Because I believe that before 1679, Newton did not have a key ingredient that he needed to really advance. He had already made progress in understanding things, you know, going beyond just circular motion. And he knew that elliptical motion depended on inverse square forces and that. But you know, concepts like angular momentum and so were obscure because the methods he was using didn't reveal that. Now, he had a correspondent with Robert Hooke. And of course, many of you know about Hooke's law, about the spring, and you probably wonder what is a guy who writes such trivialities know about physics. Well, before Newton, Hooke was the greatest scientist certainly in England, and you know, with the exception of Huygens in Holland, he really had no match. And but he annoyed Newton when Newton wrote a theory of colors. Hooke was very dismissive, and Newton was a guy with a very thin skin and didn't like the treatment he got from Hook, and so he always had a... Anyway, Hook became the secretary of the Royal Society and wrote a nice letter to Newton and said, look, let's continue our discussion. You know, I will keep everything between us, because he knew that Newton didn't like... and in particular, he said, look, I've got this idea. You know, often in physics, an idea starts with some mental concept, but you haven't put it, he didn't put it into mathematics. He said, look, suppose that gravitational force is not a continuous force, it's just made up of periodic impulses. Say a central force, you have the sun here, you have a planet here, and instead of thinking of a continuous gravitational force or a center, think of it as, you know, an impulse towards the center in between, periodic in between the planet is moving according to inertia. And in fact, if you look at your numerical computations, they're always like that. They're also always made of impulses. You never compute anything numerically in the continuum. So Hooke's idea was that, and he asked Newton what he thought of it. And I think that was a mistake of his life. He should have asked Leibniz or somebody else, because Newton ran away with the idea. Newton knew how to implement this simple idea of kicks and periodic kicks with the inertial motion into a mathematical form. And that, of course, was the beginning of the Principia. Now, I will skip all this, and if there is time and people are interested, I will talk about. This is what Newton knew beforehand, and I believe the method he used to do this, it had nothing to do with the idea of impulses, okay? So it's not too relevant today. I actually wrote a paper on how Newton used other, what I call curvature method, or to reproduce what he did many years ago. But the trouble with that method, using the curvature of an orbit, is that it doesn't give you any physical insight on what's going on. You don't get angular momentum conservation, energy, none of the nice things about physics emerges from this. On the other hand, as I will show you from the idea of Hooke, all these things immediately became apparent. And by the way, Newton literally confessed to Halley in correspondence that it was Hooke who put him on the right track. Now, one of the reasons, by the way, why I think that he wasn't just worrying about smatters in mathematics. My opinion, he didn't want to give Hooke any credit, which he didn't in his book. He would have had to credit Hooke with the important idea. And by this time, Hooke was his arch enemy, and he wanted to avoid any mention of Hooke. And so he left out anything. And Hooke got a hold of the first draft. And there is a fantastic... I went to the library and the Trinity College in the archives, and there's a fantastic manuscript, and here is a diagram where Hooke implemented the idea after, in my opinion, people have, historians are in dispute, but in my opinion, he saw the first draft of Newton and how he did it, and he implemented it and showed graphically and analytically that if the force is linear, he didn't do the inverse square force, but if the force depends linearly on the distance, you know, it's like what you see in a pendulum, then the orbit is also an elliptical orbit. In fact, if you look at a segment of it, if you put away all the auxiliary lines, I mean, it's a remarkably accurate. In fact, it's very remarkable that using impulses, the vertices of the impulses lie exactly on the ellipse. That's a peculiar property of the linear force, that you're exactly on the ellipse. And uh, I, I, And this was drawn, and I saw this, and it was drawn 2 years before the Principia. Now, in my opinion, had Hooke published this, he could have published this result and have a little footnote and say, I'd like to thank Isaac Newton for his contribution. I mean, the history of the whole subject would have been very different, but Hooke was in bad shape, you know, his mistress had just died, and he was always running around. He couldn't really sit there long enough to carry anything out. So he had everything in, he had all the ideas there, and he didn't do that. And so that history turns out to be different. I followed exactly his initial conditions, but I said instead of making them linear, I made them inverse square force. And then as you can see, if you make an inverse square force, the center of force is no longer at the center, but it's at a focus. The problem with these initial conditions and these steps is that when you get very close, of course, the impulses get very large. Inverse square force, they get larger and larger. And the graphical calculation diverges. And I have a suspicion that Hooke tried that and saw the divergence, and he couldn't make any sense of it. And, well, you know, he should have changed his initial conditions a little bit, making them less, making the eccentricity less, because then it works. Yeah, as I said, Newton. Newton at least admitted in 1686, that's 2 years after the publication, that it was his interaction with Hooke that really, there's a lot on these slides, and you don't need to read everything. But if there are questions afterwards, I wanted to put it down so that I can show you what. Yeah, so let's skip that. Now I thought I would show you in a few lines how it works. Okay. So you start with the following. You want to see how to draw an orbit, okay? So what you have to start with is you have the center of force. You're sitting over here, right? So this is the distance, okay? Some length, okay? And then you go and you draw another length, and that is the distance you would move between impacts. It's velocity times the whatever periodic time you have. And now comes the trick. You see, Newton says, let's extend that line. And I go from capital B to little c. And assume that when you get to capital B, which is the end of the trajectory, inertial trajectory, right here, you have an impulse towards the center. Now, the magnitude of the impulse, we can discuss that later, but that's, of course, another variable, depends on the magnitude of the force. So let's just put some impulse there. And now what you have to do is figure out how to add the two, because now you have to add, we would say you add the two velocities, the one you get from the bat hitting the ball, and the one that you got from the initial inertia when somebody threw the ball at you. You have to add to get the next displacement, and that just means you have to, and that's a piece of cake, right? But that was the contribution, that was the only contribution Newton did, is to show that you have to add it vectorially, and then you go to the next step. And now, let's repeat this a number of times. Let's say we repeat it four times, and you get a discrete orbit And this orbit, this discrete orbit, assumes that the impacts are independent of the distance. Now, historians go bananas when they see this. How dumb of Newton. Why would he treat constant impulses instead of inverse square impulses that depend on the inverse square of the distance? But Newton kept saying, and he said that very clearly, you know, this is the simplest case. Well, it's the simplest case if you want to do it if you want to do it graphically, because you don't have to change the magnitude of the impulse. And it's when I realized, that all the impulses, see all these three impulses, this one, this one, this one, and this one, they're all the same, even though you're changing the distance from the center. This has apparently no physical interest. But mathematically, it's the simplest case, because otherwise you have to scale every time you have to scale the magnitude of the impulse by the distance from the center. Now, I never realized the importance of the fact that the diagram, this is Newton's, this is actually the printed diagram. And I once scaled it up, you know, and I checked that the impulses, you know, when I scaled it up to 10 centimeters, that the impulses were accurately equal in the diagram to 1 millimeter. So he was drawing actually the result of a carefully graphical computation, because you don't know where those impulses are. There's an auxiliary line that we can talk about later, but they have nothing to do with it. And now, if you don't mind, for 3 minutes, I have a little video that I made, which basically, you know, just repeats this calculation. And all you need to do it is a pencil and a ruler. So forget calculus, you know. I mean, that's of course all he had. And so, if you don't believe that you can do it with a pencil and a ruler, here's my my video. Now, there's the ruler, there's the pencil, and you know, you draw the initial displacement, then you draw the initial distance, then you draw the initial displacement. Okay, this only takes a few minutes, and then you extend that. You have to extend that by an equal amount, because if there's no force, it would continue. But because there is an impulse, you have to now add up. You now have to add up the impulse, which is towards the center. And the simplest way to do it is to draw the impulse from the end of that line. You know, you make the impulse whatever line distance it is, and you join. And there is the next point. And now you have 2 points on the orbit. And I won't bore you. The next point, I accelerated my. So you see accelerating the video. You see I make the 4 points by hand. And lo and behold, I'll show you the result. I mean, you might think that I'm cheating. So there it is, okay. There's Newton's proposition for diagram one, and there's my diagram. Now here's the question, why stop there? Why only four impacts? What happens if you continue these impacts? There it is, I mean, you get a nice orbit. And is it just an uninteresting orbit? Well, if you roll a ball inside of an inverted cone, you turn out that the transverse force is exactly a constant. And lo and behold, this simple graphical calculation reproduces an observation, namely a ball rolling in an inverted cone. Now, I didn't bring my inverted cone because I have to have it on a train, but here's a stereoscopic view of how the ball goes. And lo and behold, actually, if you notice something interesting, by the way, if you want to teach students, you can, that completely obeys Kepler's area law because angular momentum is conserved, and you know, it's just like an ellipse, but the axis of the ellipse is changing, and you know, it looks very much like Newton's calculation, except Newton didn't do that. Okay. I have to give credit to my son because he's the video guru, and I had to, I needed a lot of help to do the video. Now you can do the graphics and then write down the analytic form of them, and lo and behold, you get, you don't get Euler's formula that we teach our entering students. You get a much more sophisticated analytic process, which is symplectic. I think you are familiar with it, because we used it in the days of chaos, and you needed an area preserver algorithm. And this algorithm, by the way, has been rediscovered numerous times by various people in the process without realizing that it's Newton's algorithm. In fact, recently I had a conversation with the author of Numerical Recipes, and he didn't know this, and I said, I hope in your next edition you will credit Newton with it and not somebody else. Just for fun, as I mentioned earlier, all the manuscripts after the Principia, or pre-Principia manuscript, but after 1684, are now online. And here's a manuscript, one of the earliest manuscripts that he sent to the Royal Society. And what's interesting is, you can see here, what am I doing wrong? Oh yeah, here we go. What you can see here is that you see this diagram that appears in the final publication. And it still is exactly to scale. The impacts are equal. It's a different diagram, but the letters are different, but it's still doing to scale. And the other thing that's important is, since he didn't have a vector calculus, hadn't been invented yet, it came later, like 100 years later with Hamilton and so forth. But you know, he invented the parallelogram, which he used to do the calculation. So it's all there. Well, about 5 more minutes, okay? Is that okay? I think I'm just about near the end. And there's another different diagram. This diagram is still the same, but it's a different, it has different initial conditions, so it is somewhat different. And of course, all the book says is it's a diagram to prove a theorem. But it's much more than that. I believe it's a diagram that describes how you do a graphical calculation. But his mom, and amazingly, I've now talked to historians, I mean, nobody's, so far as I know, I mean, one of the questions I have, if anybody here knows, anybody pointing out that this is not just a diagram for a proof of a theorem, but it's actually a diagram which you can continue. And I, you know, I made different orbits. This is, of course, the constant force. And as I said, it very well reproduces calculations and other observations. And if you want to do it for different initial conditions, I mean, here are calculations. This one with initial conditions like Newton's, but inverse square force diverges, just like Hooke's. But if you change the initial condition, you can get nice elliptical orbits. What you have to do is make the angle, the initial angle, not that steep. And I suspect Newton made them steep, so if anybody was smart enough to figure out what he was doing, they would get into trouble, right? I mean, he did, you know, those of you who know about Newton know that he was a, let's not go into it. Here's what happens if you can make it into a circle or into an ellipse. In linear forces, you can make an ellipse with the central force in the center. And with inverse square, depending on initial condition, you can have parabolic motion, right? Not just elliptical motion. And even interestingly enough, you can do the calculation graphically if you have an inverse cube force. And Newton treated that too in his book. And you know what happens? If you have an inverse cube force, you get an ellipse. And I was able to calculate ellipse with finite steps, but they have to make them small, okay? I mean, the trouble with if you don't make them small enough, you get too close to the center. But even the spiral motion with an inverse cube force can be done graphically. So I believe that if you now are in a position, you don't have to, you know, you can pull up. I mean, I really would like to, particularly our younger generation who may be now working on string theory and black holes and what have you, but if you teach physics to students, show them how to do this graphically, because I think it has some educational value too. Oh, by the way, you may wonder what happens if you decrease the size of the impacts. I mean, this thing converges like a bomb. It's really remarkably convergent. Not only a good numerical method, but if you say you make the displacements half the size, the impacts have to make a quarter, right? Because the impacts are quadratic. And the convergence, you know, the three colors tell you how rapidly the convergence is. So you converge rapidly. It's a nice, very nice tool. It's time reversal. And I end up with a quotation of Laplace. Knowledge of the method that has guided a man of genius is no less useful to the progress of science than to his glory, than his discoveries. The method is often the most interesting part. Newton hit the method. Well, thank you. Now, please make your questions. I have very bad hearing, but maybe you can repeat a question if.
So, where does the development of calculus fit in here?
Where does it?
This method, graphical method, is, you know, in the limiting case you were discussing. Right?
Well, you have to go to the continuum, right?
So, that's. But when did this kind of method lead him to calculus, or did it?
Did this method lead him to calculus? Well, you know, he doesn't say so. but no, he, you know, if you read the literature, he was contemptuous of the analytic method. He said Descartes actually, who started the analytic method that ended with the calculus, he was contemptuous of it. He said, look, geometry is much more beautiful, more presentable, and you know, he even tried his hands at F equal ma, and there's very little that you can find, and the little that you can find is dubious. You know, this requires second order calculations, analytic calculations. He could do second order graphical calculations, and that is a tremendous tour de force. But analytically, well, you know, there are people who think he couldn't do it right.
When did he decide on the 1 over r squared versus something else?
Oh, he must have, he knew it was 1 over r squared back to when he was still a student in Cambridge. And the reason that he knew that it was 1 over r squared is that he was comparing the force to the moon to the gravitational force on the Earth. And It didn't fit very well because he didn't have the radius of the Earth properly. So he got it poorly. But then he computed the periods of the planets, assuming it was one over R squared. And he got the periods beautifully. Or maybe the other way around. He assumed the periods that had been measured, and he found that it implied one over R squared. You know, it's a period, a relation between the period and the radius is T squared is proportional to the cube. And he knew that already as a student. So, but then he did all that for circular,
He knew that ahead of the geometric
model. Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, this goes back to the beginning. But you see, Kepler had a much bigger challenge. I mean, okay, it's a piece of cake to do the circular motion, but Kepler challenged everybody by saying the motion of the planet is not circular. It's, you know, there is an eccentricity, and what can you say about the motion if it's eccentric? And Newton was damn sure he was going to work that out too. And he was stuck until Hooke helped him.
But the calculus came after? I just wonder, when did the calculus...
The calculus, at that time, the story of the calculus is very muddled because he had a huge controversy with Leibniz, who claims Leibniz plagiarized him. You know that story, right? And so Newton would like to claim that he developed the calculus, not at that time, but very soon thereafter. Like in 1669, he had the basis of it. He didn't publish anything. But he sent out manuscripts. In those days, you sent out manuscripts, you know, preprints. So he sent out a lot of preprints, and he claimed that Leibniz got a hold of them. But he didn't use the calculus. Of course, by the time he started doing more sophisticated calculations, like perturbation calculations, you see in proposition 41, he talks about given an integral. He calls it given the area of the curve. Given the area, but how the hell do you calculate the area, right, of a certain problem like inverse square force without having calculus? And he didn't write anything in the book. But if you look at the manuscripts, the good mathematicians went to see him. One of them was, forgot his name, he came down to see Newton. And Newton, we have a manuscript where Newton explained how he did the calculus. So, but that was in 1689, 2 years after the publication. So a lot of things, of course, once he had the thing going, well, you know, as all great scientists, then of course you want to push things further, and he did that. He had the genius to do that. Yeah, could you repeat that question?
He's asking if there's any evidence he was really aware of Leibniz's work.
Was he aware of Leibniz?
The detail.
Or appreciated it more than he did.
How much did he know about Leibniz's work?
How much did he that Newton know about Leibniz's work? Yeah. Well, there's an enormous literature on that, and. He dismissed Leibniz. He didn't like his formalism. The trouble with Leibniz, Leibniz had a formalism that we use in our elementary calculus. Well, you don't have to think. Leibniz said, look, I give you a formalism. I give you the tools. So you don't even have to think to solve all these problems. I give you the right notation. He has a notation, he invented a notation we use today. And the trouble with that notation is you don't even have to think what it means. Okay? Delta x over delta y is the x dy. And so Leibniz had a tremendous influence in describing the right language in which to describe. Newton had the dot formalism, but you know, we don't use that and his fluxions and all that stuff. It wasn't very transparent, and nobody except in England used it. In the continent, everybody went with the Leibniz. If it weren't for Leibniz, there would have been very little progress with Newton's book. It was Leibniz that Bernoulli, I mean, I named the half dozen of mathematicians who made further progress in the continent. They used Leibniz's calculus.
This reminds me of the situation with Schwinger and Feynman.
Yeah. They are perilous. They are perilous by all means, you know. You know, I had Feynman. I listened to Feynman's lecture when I was a student, and he came around to talk about the magnetic moment. And he said, well, today, you know, our lecture will be on the magnetic moment, which was done by Professor And then somebody in the back said, Schwinger! Feynman wouldn't even get around to you Schwinger's name. And I think there was a rivalry there, very similar to the rivalry between Newton and... You're going to have to repeat the question, yes, please.
The question is, have you thought about the thinking that Newton did with alchemy? And
oh, yeah, yeah.
Years?
What about all these other all these other things? You know, historians are, since they can't do the mathematics and they can't understand the real meat, they go off on a, you know, it's like, for me, Newton's alchemy, his religious studies and all that is like, some physicists play golf, okay? Now, nobody cares. I'm sorry, no, I didn't mean to get anybody here who likes golf or tennis, but you know, why does anybody care about whether a physicist plays golf or tennis or what have you? It's irrelevant. And all the stuff he did on alchemy and so on, but the historians, he wrote more about alchemy and all that than he wrote about physics. And historians occupy themselves with that essentially nonsense.
He spent more time on alchemy than the president spent playing golf.
Yeah. It was a what?
Well,
the alchemy was?
Spent more time on alchemy than the...
Well, you know, I don't really buy that. You know, nobody was there to really see how much time he spent on one thing or another. He wrote more about alchemy, probably, and religious studies than he wrote about physics. That doesn't mean that he spent more time on that. Because he was doing hard work when he was doing mathematics and physics, and the alchemy stuff was, you know, kid's play. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. You know, but I mean, maybe this religious study, and because I think that what was kind of crucial, this notion of actions at distance. An action at distance, I think, was contradicting, you know, kind of...
Oh, yeah, 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 that's it.
And in this sense, it could be religious.
That was a very, very interesting controversy.
Yeah.
You see, on the continent, they said that Newton had turned into occult forces.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, everything that Descartes has taught, that Torah taught them is that, you know, you needed an impact. Okay? So Descartes had this idea that planets move because they were pushed around by vortices and all that. And so you needed impact. So where was the impact in Newton's theory? I mean, you had occult forces. And of course, that the people in the continent, they accepted his mathematics, but didn't accept his physics. You know, it's a funny thing because I think there's some relation to what's going on today, you know. What does dark energy, what does dark matter do? I mean, in those days, the dark energy and the dark matter were occult too. They were occult forces. And Newton was very, you know, he was our first model of scientific, he said, hypothesis non fingo. I mean, there's a one of the few things I can, Latin sentences, meaning I don't make any assumptions about.
But maybe it was his despair, because he could not explain this.
Maybe a square.
Despair.
Despair. Unhappiness.
Unhappy, yeah. No, anyway, Newton was very clever, and you know, he also made a clear statement about what are the limits of our field. You know, obviously Einstein made great progress by at least giving some further developments of the causes of gravity. In those days, gravity was just an action at a distance. So was electromagnetism. I don't know why people were so furious about gravity, because they knew magnets could also act at a distance. They didn't have electricity, but they had magnets. So why were they so persistent in not accepting that gravity could act at a distance, but magnets would too? I don't understand that. To me, you know, this is all hogwash. It's a waste of time to try to. But you know, if you want to write, there's more literature on that stuff. I mean, every year there are 3 or 4 books. The latest book is by one of the gurus called The Priest of, Newton is the Priest of Nature. Have you seen that, the title, Priest of Nature? The entire book is about his alchemy and his religious stuff. And then colleagues of mine in Caltech, who in the history of science, wrote about an enormously fat book, History's Idea, the History of Civilization. Newton was interested in how. And he used biblical, he talked about the Argonauts and all kinds of nonsense. I mean, fat books on this stuff, I don't know why people waste their time on it.
One quick comment in support of your point that Newton deliberately made.
Okay, can you come a little closer so I can?
So, in support of your comment that Newton deliberately made things difficult.
Okay.
So I have some experience of this from having the privilege at St. John's to be with a bunch where I did my undergrad, to do a bunch, go through a bunch of Newton's Principia with other undergraduates, most of whom were more interested in the humanities, perhaps, and did not go on to become theoretical physicists. So one example of this is that Newton will often do, you know, if you're doing orbits, you can have different conic sections. You can have the ellipse or the hyperbola. So you will often do just one case, like the hyperbola. And then he'll say he will assert that the same thing is true about the ellipse, but he won't prove it. You just have to know that any proof you can make for the hyperbola, you can what I as a would call Wick rotate to get to the ellipse case, and you have to understand this, you know, conic sections at a pretty deep level to see that.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of barrier he was putting up.
Yeah, Newton, you know, Newton became the Lucasian professor after his mentor, who was actually a very great mathematician, Isaac Barrow. Isaac Barrow saw his student so much exceeded his talent that he decided to retire and become a minister. And Newton then had to give lectures. And he gave lectures on, or at least he gave lectures on the theory of colors. And there are accounts that he literally gave lectures to the walls because nobody could follow. I mean, he was so obscure and so difficult that students stopped attending his lectures. And he would, you know, he would give his lectures and submit it to get approval from whoever was the chair of the department.
Can you just describe the relationship between the mechanics in Kipia and the later optical work, the optics?
The optics, yeah.
Question is about the relationship of his mechanics work to his later optics work.
Is there a relation? Oh yeah, there's definitely a relation. Newton had the view, of course the wrong view, he had the view that optics really consisted of corpuscles, particles of light. And the beautiful thing is, and it's very remarkable, because I wrote recently a paper on this, that if you assume that light is made of particles instead of a wave theory, okay, well, of course they are photons, but that, let's forget about that. Suppose that instead of having waves, you have particles. And how do you explain refraction, reflection, and the rest of it? Well, it's very easy. And in fact, even more interesting is that Newton knew that light coming from a star, because he was in close contact with Flamsteed, the astronomer, you know that when you look at a star or at the sun, it's not where you think it is, because light has to go through the atmosphere, and therefore it's bent by traversing the atmosphere. The light doesn't travel in straight lines, except for short distances. So, but you know, everything comes out right if you assume that light, if you assume the right dynamics. I mean, you can write equations of motion and get exactly Snell's law, which is very remarkable. And of course, it was one of the reasons why it took a century before Newton's theory of light finally fell apart. But he just simply could do the dynamics of beams of light just like he could do the dynamics of particles. Just that the law of force is, different.
Interference.
Interference gave him a headache. No, absolutely. And interference, incidentally, to his best credit, Newton was, he wasn't just a tremendously great theorist. He did his experiments. And he did an experiment where he basically let light, he took a scissors, between the scissors he let the light transmit, a beam of light. He usually had light coming in through a hole in his room, and then he had a, and so he noticed that when light goes through, you see interference fringes, okay? And he tried desperately to calculate the location of this interference fringes. Well, when I learned about this, I calculate where the interference fringes for his particular experiment would lie. And to my absolutely it was stunning that the position that he gave for the interference fringes are exactly where they should be based on the wave theory of light. And even people who've written on optics, like Shapiro and so on, wasn't aware of it, that Newton, first of all, was a fantastic observation. I mean, his experiments, he was very, very accurate. You know, when he did his interference experiment, the ring interference experiment, okay, he measured things to thousands of an inch. Well, you know how he did that? I mean, how can you measure the thickness of the wire that he made the hole to 1/10,000th of an inch? I mean, how do you do it? Anybody here knows how he did it? Well, of course, when Newton does something, and after he tells you how he did it, it's trivial. He put all these pins next to each other and measured, say, 100 pins to see how much of a width. And of course, he had a fairly good average of the size of the, but you needed, of course, the size of the pinhole to measure the interference fringes. I mean, everything he did, Hooke was very good too, but he exceeded Hooke's techniques by a great amount.
I had a chance to take a look at Kepler's manuscript this summer, and the derivations there were also geometrical, and they seemed to those that you showed today, that was made by, Newton's. I was wondering, what was the hardship that Kepler couldn't surmount, yet Newton could?
I mean, Kepler was a superb mathematician. The observations were done by Tycho Brahe, and Kepler was his what do we call it? It's the theory in residence. But after Kepler, after Tycho Brahe died, Kepler was finally able to get all the data. And he went through the data and he tried to fit it everything with the Ptolemaic, you know, wasn't the current ideas of epicycles and so on. By the way, there's a lot of nonsense about epicycles too. People talk about the fact that people were building more and more epicycles to fit more accurately, and in fact, but anyway, Kepler tried to fit the data with epicycles, and you know, he could have done it, but he then realized that a better fit of the data was with an ellipse, putting the sun at the focus of the ellipse. And so his great second law, you know, said that the motion, the first law said that the motion was an ellipse. The second law, of course, was that the areas swept were all equal. And the third law, of course, was the relation between the period and the... Now, these were three laws which Kepler got from very accurate observations, but there was no theory for it. I mean, Kepler believed that planets were pushed around by angels in the direction of the, but in fact, planets were pushed perpendicular. I don't know if anybody is interested in a few minutes. I want to show you a 3-minute video that I got from Richard Feynman. Richard is the only guy who I know got interested, and he gave the Cornell lectures. Has anybody seen the Cornell lectures on what he calls the... are you interested? I'll show the video. It's again a short video, but you will see that Feynman, in fact, gave a lecture in which he proved Kepler's area law exactly along the lines.
That if the forces are directed toward the sun, then the equal areas are swept out at equal time. So if we start here's the sun, and we imagine at a certain time, let's say the planet is here, and it's moving in such a way that, let's say, 1 second later or 1 hour, pick any time, let's say 1 second later, it's moved in such a manner that it has gotten to the position 2. Now, if the sun did not exert any force on it, then by Galileo's principle, it would keep right on going in a straight line. So in the same interval of time, later, the next second, it'll move exactly the same distance in the same straight line to the position 3, were there no force. All right, now first we're going to show that if there's no force, equal areas are swept out at equal time. I remind you that the area of a triangle is half the base times the altitude, and that the altitude is the vertical distance to the base, and that if the triangle is sort of cockeyed, there's a name for it which I forget, obtuse, then the altitude is this vertical height here. See, I know about the triangles, I just don't know the name. Now let us draw the lines to these two points in the case that there was no motion whatsoever. The question is, doesn't draw very well, I'm not accurate. But these two distances are equal, remember. Question is, are these two areas equal? Well, consider the triangle made from the sun and the two points 1 and 2. It's this one. What's its area? It's this base multiplied by this height. And what about the other triangle, which is the triangle in motion from 2 to 3? It's this base times the same altitude. The two triangles have the same altitude, and as I indicated, the same base and have the same area. So far, so good. If there were no force from the sun, equal areas would be swept out in equal time. The two triangles have equal areas. But there is a force from the sun. And during this interval, 1 to 2 to 3, the sun is pulling and changing the motion in various directions, this way, that way. To get a good approximation to that, we'll take the central position or average position here and say that the whole effect during this interval was to change the motion by some amount in this direction toward the sun. That means that although the particles were moving this way and would have moved this way in the next second, because of the influence of the sun, the motion is altered by an amount that's poking in this direction, that's parallel to this, exactly parallel. These lines are parallel. It's the direction in which this new motion is. The new motion is a compound of what I wanted to do and the change that's been induced by the action of the sun. So it doesn't really end up at position 3, but rather at position 4. So now we would like to compare, getting complicated in the diagram, the triangle 24S and 23S. Okay, I'll show you that those are equal. Because they have the same base, those two triangles, this one here, and the one that happened when we had no force. The one with force and with no force have the same base. And do they have the same altitude? Sure, because they're included between parallel lines, and so they have the same altitude. And thus the area of the last triangle I drew is the same as the second one I drew, this one. You know, now I have proved earlier was the same as the first one. So in the actual orbital motion of the planet, the area of the first, in the first, in the second, and in the second, second are equal. So by reasoning, we can see a connection between the force, the fact that the force is toward the sun, and that the areas are equal. Not ingenious, no? This was, I borrowed this from Newton. It comes right out of the Principia diagram and all. The letters are different, that's all. Because he wrote in Latin. These are Arabic numerals. But,
Anyway, that's the end of it. At the end, he admits that he got it out of the Principia. So Feynman at least learned a lot. And by the way, if you read Feynman's lectures, the famous lectures of Feynman, he also gives the analytic form without crediting Newton of elliptical motion.